444-1977. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
Queen Ida, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM on your radio. Your spot for Cajun and Zydeco music, Bon Ton Roulet.
Dr. Zom's Stereo Obscura. Offbeat sounds for talented listeners. Broadcasts every other Wednesday at 10 p.m.
De nuevo, esta música divina.
There was heaven, and there was earth.
Después de esta pieza, vamos a escuchar una comunicación simpática y cruel con Annie.
That's Dr. Zom's Stereo Obscura. Every other Wednesday from 10 to midnight. Here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Pacifica Radio in San Francisco. This is Dennis Bernstein with Miguel Gavila Molina. Today on the Flashpoint Show, Culture Clash founder and award-winning playwright Richard Montoya joins us today to talk about the ongoing battles against the anti-immigrant violence taking place in Southern California and across the state. And also joining the discussion, Professor Lorraine Gonzalez, counselor and La Raza Studies faculty member at Contra Costa College. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein, joined here by our senior producer, Miguel Gavilan Molina. And we have one of my favorite guests and an honor to have with us again, the great Richard Montoya, Culture Clash founder, award-winning playwright, engaged at so many levels now, Richard, in trying to resist the expanding racism and the violence behind it. You're there in Southern California. You're taking your kids to school. Can you just give us an overview? What's the atmospheric pressure? How does it boil down now? Life is changing, isn't it?
You know, hi, Dennis. How are you?
Welcome.
Padre Miguel Gavilan and all your listeners up there in the beautiful Republic of Berkeley. You know, we're feeling a little more defiant and resistance. And, you know, we never allowed ourselves to dip into despair, but we had not forgotten, but reminded ourselves that as creatives, we have tools and weapons, and certainly you and Miguel, my father, the great Jose Montoya, the poet, the Royal Chicano Air Force, Los Chilenos de Berkeley, so many people are there to remind us that we can also fight this battle. Every movement needs a song, and the song for this movement is more youthful. My 15-year-old son and his friends have taken to the streets as well, and they're out there, and we're just trying to support them with our art, with our theater, with our music, and so the feeling, Dennis, to answer your question is maybe a little bit more defiance than we felt a couple of months ago, watching ICE retreat from some of the big city centers. But we can't let our guard down. This thing is far from people are still being disappeared and separated, and can happen anytime. You can get that knock on your window or ask for things, but to the end of the creativity and the fighting back, our old friend Lalo Alcaraz, La Cucaracha Lalo, the old Chicano Cal Berkeley Bear himself, he's put together a wonderful project with Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine, a whole host of rappers and creative folks have put together a double LP on vinyl. It's called Ice Out, and it each artist is able to make a statement, a song, in my case a spoken word piece, about this atrocity, this calamity, this danger to our people. But, you know, we have that outlet. We have that outlet on KPFA with you all. And that's turned out to be a very useful weapon from Seattle to Minnesota to Los Angeles. We're fighting back with some modicum of creativity, and it's helping to turn the tide a little bit, I think, Dennis. I don't want to be Pollyanna about it, but I feel a little more hopeful today than I did a couple of weeks ago.
Well, that's good to hear. You know, clearly the idea is to intimidate, is to scare, is to frighten, and that way undermine people's ability to do the things that they love to do, they need to do. So sort of this thing about, it's really not about not being afraid, is it? It's about how to move forward in the face of your fear, because the fears are realistic, but life has bigger things in mind. Richard.
Yeah, and the fear is—it's real, but it's not useful. I'm watching the junior high and high school kids out there. We call them Edgars. They have the Edgar haircut. It's a very popular haircut amongst young Central American and Mexican kids.
Yes.
Those are the kids out there throwing blows with cops. They're getting tackled down to the ground. They're getting zip tied in the back. They're getting thrown on the cement, and they're getting thrown into the backs of cars. It's not us boomers, you know, it's not a necessarily Gen Xers, but it's those Gen Z kids that are out there, and they're out there with their allies with skateboards, and I'm seeing in the case of my son's high school, the Anglo kids are walking arm in arm with the Latino kids, man, and the African American kids and the Asian kids. They're all out there. They've had enough. They know that the emperor is corrupt. They know this is really dark times, and they're that inspires me too, man. That's what's got me feeling a little bit better too, is that the kids are all right and the kids are punching back.
Beautiful. Beautiful. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We have with us the wonderful Richard Montoya of Culture Clash, Culture Clash, and many important projects. Also joining us is a good old friend of yours, Richard, Miguel Gavala Molina. I know that you have a question or two for our good brother from the South.
Absolutely. And it's a concern, I think, that we all have as parents. And I know, Richard, that, you know, as a father and, you know, with Montaña in high school and Luna, you know, in grade school, it can be really stressful. You know, I've heard some child ask in one of these situations where there was a raid, you know, ask, you know, are the masked men with guns going to shoot us? I mean, these are little kids. These are grade school kids. I mean, there used to be a time, Richard, back in the day, in my day, where, you know, there was all these alerts, you know, the Cold War, you know, possibly, you know, atomic war. And we'd have these drills where you hide under the desk. Well, today it's, you know, running with your teacher or your, you know, yard duty teacher, running to hide somewhere, you know, while the masked men with guns show up. I mean, that must be really stressful to think of that. And also, you know, when you're, you know, when the kids, you know, my goddaughter and my godson have to, you know, be dealing with that rather than going to school and feeling safe and secure. Are you feeling some of that as a parent?
I am, Miguel, and I'm sorry to go not surprised that your godchildren are feeling that and what it is, guys, it's terror. I've heard children shriek with terror, you know, in the backs of cars as the windows are being shattered, as mom's being grabbed through a window. You know how many injuries you get when you are dragged through a broken window, a car window? You get lacerations and you get glass all over you. And this terror, and man, you just spend a couple of minutes on social medias, and we're just seeing the tip. I mean, there's, and then there's regular American citizens that are now emboldened to confront anyone, and they'll call you, you know, wetback and worse right in front of your children, you know, and oftentimes you have to defend or take care of your kids or answer back to folks that have, you know, that failed every test to become a police officer, that now find themselves empowered by the office of the ICE. And this terror of Stephen Miller, you know, it's not going to just go away. We are not going to forget. And we, Dennis and Miguel, we have to find that spot of where we are in 2026 with this armed encroachment, this armed targeting of our people. I've always been a loyal Cesar Chavista, you know, and Cesar's, the core tenet of Cesar's entire philosophy was nonviolence. And we have adhered to that like good Catholics. We adhered to Cesar's call for, you know, turning the cheek. But I'll tell you, man, in the last year, I've had to read a little bit more of Corky Gonzalez from Colorado and Corky and Tijerina from New Mexico. They were forced because they were in a little bit more violent of a situation. So if you remember the movie The Black Klansman, that was all based in Denver, Colorado, and that was the central base for Corky Gonzalez. So the FBI didn't just infiltrate the Black Panthers. They infiltrated Corky and the Brown Berets, and so there was violence. There was, I remember, you know, Chicano gas stations being blown up. And what would happen in Denver is that some of the kids that didn't get the memo from Cesar Chavez, there was young raza that bombed back, they shot back. So there was loss of life, there was loss of limb, and although we don't preach that, we abhor that, I can certainly understand now that there are some people out there that are getting close, because we are getting pushed to the edge by the violence and the terror of Stephen Miller, who's single-handedly, with Corey Lewandowski, running the policy, the immigrant policy of the U.S. It's hate-filled, it's xenophobic, as we know, and people are dying. So when Kamala and now Gavin flirting around, I'm listening to her, and I'm a great friend of Charlie Kirk, and I can talk to Steve Bannon. We don't want to hear that crap, man. The Dems lost this, Biden lost this, and you know what? People have died. And I don't think we have time for a Clintonian Kamala Harris listening tour of any kind. And I'm happy that the younger generations, much younger than myself, are not going to tolerate this crap any longer. We're tired of explaining who we are and that we can get along with everyone. You know what? Maybe we can't get along with everybody, you know? Maybe I don't want to sing folkloric songs that talk about my heart. Maybe I need to know more about who you are, who's on the other side of this. And so there we are.
Yeah, I think you are right, Richard, that at the core here is resistance, and we see this, as you said earlier, building up in the community, in the younger community. And I see a lot of militancy when I'm out on the street, and it's inspiring. It's a big battle, though. At this point, the things that are going on, we are, as you point out, people are being murdered in the street. People are being ripped through their windows, as you say, and murdered in the streets. Trump That's has right. felt empowered to do that kind of death squad killing, right? That's sort of the direction.
Absolutely. And fishing boats and on the high seas, and any brown person they want to eradicate, yes. they're doing it. And they're having a go at it, you know, quite a go. Stephen Miller
we're watching it all, Richard. We're watching it all from here to Cuba and back again, Venezuela.
Watching Cash Patel suck down beers. And what's lovely, Dennis and Miguel, is that the Epstein saga continues to unravel, and it's the noose is growing ever tighter around the Epstein class, the power structure. It's you know, not one arrest, but man, detention centers, they can't build them fast enough. There's not one immigrant named in the Epstein files, not one, a Mexican, Latin, Latino immigrant named, not a one.
Yeah, good to point that out. Dennis Berenstain with Miguel Garvin La Molina. We are out of time with you, as always. Honored to be with you, Mr. Montoya. Is there something coming up you want to tell us about that you got in the fire?
I want to tell your people up there that the great Jimmy Smith and Juan de Jesus, great partners that they are, great friends of La Raza and Culture Clash, are on stage at Berkeley Rep right now with Arthur Miller's All My Sons. It's a great Boricua, Puerto Riqueño adaptation of a classic, American classic. And so go see Jimmy Smith and Juan de Jesus at the great Berkeley Rep, man. That you won't be, let's carry the Bad Bunny vibes all the way through. And it's part of our resistance is to go.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you for all your beautiful time, Richard. Thank you. Gotta go.
Thank you for having me, Dennis. I'm honored. Okay.
Honor. Miguel and I are always joyous. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to continue this discussion about the expanding racism and the kinds of violence that immigrants and Latinos and anybody really who's just a shade darker than white. This is a dangerous time. Stay with us. We'll be back. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. It's your daily investigative news magazine on KPFA Pacifica, invented in 1949 by folks who understood how important it is to have a free speech, no holds barred truth to power network. I'm here with our senior producer, Miguel Gavilan Molina. We have a special guest. Would you like to introduce us, Gavilan?
Absolutely. Coming to join us here and talk about a little experience that professor witnessed. We have Community College Professor Lorena Gonzalez, who is a contributor not just to hear Flashpoints, but also to La Onda when it comes to education, part of education, and of course, cultural heritage. That said, welcome, Professor Lorena. A lot happening, you know, right now. There's a lot of tension in the air. But just this past weekend, you were down in Mexico, in Michoacán, and you witnessed a situation there. Tell us a little bit about that.
Buenas noches, everybody, and thank you for having me. Just a correction, I was in Jalisco and Puerto Vallarta. I was down there for a week and getting ready to actually headed to the airport to fly back on Sunday when we arrived to the dock in Puerto Vallarta to head to the airport and saw, of course, all the smoke, not knowing what was happening. And so, yeah, it was, we literally boated in thinking we were headed to the airport, easy peasy, just normal route, and we're met with a huge surprise, not knowing what was happening at the ground level. It wasn't very clear yet what was going on.
You said you saw smoke, you saw buses. Give us a little more of what you were seeing, what you were witnessing,
and how
you felt, and others that were with you.
Well, you know, we were on the boat transportation with a lot of the locals that were going in from the fishing town, because we were staying in a fishing town south of Vallarta. And the only mode of transportation for many of the locals is by water taxi. So we're on this boat that's the first boat that arrives in Vallarta with a lot of the workers. And same, we were all like, what's going on? Everyone had their phones out and we're recording what we're seeing. And as we got off the boat, we just started hearing mumblings and we're walking and you could smell the burning. And we were thinking, oh, well, it's an accident. And then when we saw the first car that we saw smoking, we were like, okay, this is more than just an accident. And, you know, it's very common. It's a common practice of burning cars to close roadways or closing roadways to make a point. A lot of indigenous communities use that in Michoacán specifically to draw attention to social injustice issues and things. So as we're walking, we're thinking, okay, we're just going to get past the smoke and catch a taxi. But we started seeing the restaurant workers were putting the umbrellas away and putting the chairs away, and we're right in the malecón of Vallarta. And so, you know, it's to see the employees moving in that speed of putting things away is when we realized, okay, things are pretty serious. We walked by a McDonald's, and the McDonald's that's there, and I went in to use the restroom. And as quickly as it took for me to go into the restroom, and by the time I came out, the manager had said no more service, and they weren't allowing anyone else into the restaurant. So at that point, it was like, okay, like, something serious is going on. And we just kept on walking and walking and thinking eventually, we're going to be able to get to a spot where we see a taxi. But no, what we saw instead were burning cars, and not just the main avenue, but in the neighborhoods, you saw the smoke piles all throughout the city. And so knowing at that point that they were cars burning, we right in the center of Vallarta, there was three tourist buses, which later on in the social media, we saw that they had been burned. And that was an eerie sight of realizing we had just walked by those in the morning. And the U.S. military did patrol through and were yelling through their speakers for people to go to their destinations and not to go out. And so, yeah, eventually the longer we walked, the less and less people were out in the streets. And you could see the confusion amongst a lot of the tourists. A lot of the locals were stopping, and a lot of them were just getting their stuff and leaving. But all around, you could just see this sense of surrealness, right? We're in this beautiful city and beautiful weather, and the next thing you know, it's a war zone, literally, and burning cars. I think the feeling was a bit of disbelief, and then also how quickly life can change from 1 minute to the next.
Well, Professor Lorena Gonzalez, this is incredibly important information, eyewitness information that we very much appreciate. And we appreciate the courage behind what it takes to do this kind of reporting and bring the word back to the U.S. Population, which is very much skewed when it comes to this story and undermined. And we rarely hear the truth. It's Monroe still in charge, it seems, in terms of our Congress. How do you present this now to your students, and do you want your students to engage in the kinds of politics that go on, or how does this political atmosphere and the kinds of attacks and the sweeps and everything, how does that play into your teaching and sharing an experience like this?
You know, it's definitely one of truth telling, even with the students, right? The truth of the reality of it, the feelings that went with it, the fear, the initially, you know, taking videos, right? Because it's like, oh my God, these burning cars. It's also something that's very relatable to many of the students that I work with that have fled war zones in their own countries, that are no strangers to military roaming our streets, to curfews being established. And the context is really putting it in an economic, social, political context and countering the dominant narrative, right? There's definitely a narrative that feeds into the racism of imperialism, right? And justifications for invading sovereign land. And so it's multi-layered, and it's complex in so many levels, but definitely also understanding the economic push and pull, right? That 80% of the weapons coming, where are they coming from, right? And what is Israel's role in this, and what is happening in the U.S. Connected to what happened throughout Mexico, what's happening in Palestine, right? The arms, the training that's being the money, the millions of money coming back and forth, right? The pull. Why do families go into the trade versus the others, right? The economics of migration for jobs and safety, all of that is interconnected in a way that that is not addressed in the media. And so I think that that is our role as ethnic studies professors, as Raza studies professors, as educators, right, to do that truth telling, right? It's the lies our teachers never told us, right? And reframing these experiences in a way that's bigger than individuals and families, because it's connected at a much wider global, systemic, and institutional way.
And I guess it's a good time to be a student, because it's sort of like you get a chance to integrate what you're learning in the practice of your beliefs as you participate in the streets and more of these protests that are taking place in on campus and off. What do you think, what's the message to students now, and what do we need to know about the future of our country, which is in large part the students and the young people? What do we need to know?
My message to students is that change has never happened by government. It's never happened by administrators. It's never happened by people we've necessarily voted into office. Are elected. It's happened by the youth, by the young people saying "basta ya," enough is enough. We've seen thousands and thousands of youth in California, across the country, speaking out against ICE and against the deportations, and they have demonstrated more courage than many of our own administrators and U.S. settler colonial institutions of schooling, than many of our own politically elected officials. And I think that the el movimiento siempre ha sido en la juventud. The East LA block showed us that. The students who walked out in Arizona have shown us that, right? The youth that fought against the gang injunctions in Oakland have shown us that. The youth are showing us now, right? And so don't give up on that. A lot of adults can learn from the leadership that students are demonstrating, regardless, without the titles, without the degrees, without the university crowned education that is valued, right, in the U.S. But I think that that courage, and to remember that our existence is the resistance, that had the settler colonial project succeeded, we would not be here, but yet we are here, and we are here for a purpose, and to remember that their ancestors have fought for us, to continue that fight for the next generations that are going to be on this earth, because they just have ancestors prayed for us. We are doing this work for our children and for our Mother Earth.
Beautiful. Gavilan, we have about 3 minutes. Final question for our guest of honor here tonight.
Well, absolutely. Thank you. And one of the questions I want to ask you, Professor Gonzalez, is, you know, we've seen just in this past week in one of the largest, California, the superintendent of the L.A. school district, you know, his office was raided, his home was raided. He's under some kind of investigation. And while that's happening, you know, one of the main, he has been, Superintendent Alberto Carvalho has been one of the main critics of the current administration, particularly after the dismantling of the Department of Education. So we have a situation here. At the same time, we're seeing daily reports from Santa Rosa, from San Francisco, all the way to San Jose de Los Angeles, where there's teacher strikes, schools or school boards are meeting because they're having to shut down schools. And that's really causing a lot of concern. Because when you look at the overall picture, the schools that are being closed are schools where, you know, predominantly the students are brown and black. So it's like, what is happening here? I mean, this seems to be all orchestrated. And then we see the banning of books, and the banning of books is one step where you begin to see that there's a fascist regime. The next thing you'll have is the burning of books. And you have the current administration that's pushing for a white people's history of the United States, erasing everyone else. In all of that, as an instructor, as a teacher dealing with, you know, decline of enrollment and the cutting of federal monies, how has that impacted your ability and your institution where you work to deal with all of this?
Oh, God, it's heavy. I mean, it's a definitely a heavy time. I'm, you know, as it's the cutting off of the truth telling. I think the educational system, the government is working exactly how it was intended in terms of shutting down and silencing and intimidating black and brown and indigenous voices. And books are part of that. Ethnic studies part of that. Speaking out, right? What's happening with the in Los Angeles with the superintendent? That's created intimidation, right? It's making an example of it. The force of power, right? Violence is needed, and so that violence comes in many different ways that include, right, the interruption of schools and complete intimidation. It reminds me how much our institutions are extensions of settler colonialism, and as faculty we have to, and as we have to sign oaths of allegiance to the Constitution and to the flag to even be hired, right? And I think that as much as our diversity statements and our vision statements want to be inclusive and have all this vernacular language of equity, in the end they're protecting, you know, the funding, they're protecting the institution. And so what's written in mission statements and in student equity plans is one thing, and how that plays out right now, we're seeing where values really lie within institutions and within our own government. We see how much silence there has been with our politicians that were elected to support on the backs of immigrant families and immigrant voters, and they've been silent with all of this, right? So I think that the lesson really is that it takes community. And so, yeah, you can dismantle the Board of Education, you could dismantle HSI designations, you could dismantle the grants, but guess what? The genuine education has always happened in families. It's always happened in community. And so I think we can, this is a reminder that we can't depend on the very government and institutions that continue oppressing us to also be part of the solution for us. We have to find that in our own grassroots ways, in our communities, going back to Cultura, reconnecting with nonprofit organizations, and knowing that teaching and learning doesn't always come from a textbook or within a classroom. That lived experiences, our abuelitos, abuelitas, our tios and tias, right, have so much knowledge that just because it's not codified by a U.S. institution with degrees doesn't mean that it's not valid education. And so I think that's the shift for me, is under realizing the limitation of these systems we're also products of, right? And that we're not going to have liberation within U.S. settler institutions, whether they're education, schooling ones, or government. And so how do you web that in to your classroom, to your curriculum, to your assignments, to the readings, to the books? And then how do you put it in practice by connecting your students with community, with providing opportunities of joy as assistance and advocacy, right? Understanding the deeper complex layers. And also being cautious, right? You know, it's being cautious of the language, right? Knowing, okay, we have a constitutional right of freedom of speech and freedom of expression, and being and really understanding that, knowing what college policies are regarding that, right? California code, right? The U.S. Constitution on public speaking. And so I think all of that is part of being an educator right now in the U.S. and particularly in California, because truth be told, many of us would not be working if we were in states like Florida.
Well, Professor, we're going to count on you to come back again and again and again, because your voice is so powerful in the context of what's happening now in the culture, in the society. And as a teacher and a professor and a counselor, you play an integral role in the young community that's coming up, and it's going to have to accept and deal with all this stuff. We thank you, Miguel, and I thank you from the bottom of our hearts for being with us. Hope you'll come back soon.
Thank you. Have a good night.
You too. And good luck on further travels in activism. We appreciate it. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Dennis Bernstein here with Miguel Gavilan Molina. Short break. Some of you are going to hear a chunk of yesterday's show, special programming today, and others will stay with Gavilan and I. Please stay with us and stay tuned. And we begin with our weekly segment, Pink Notes, with our co-host from Code Pink, Cynthia Papermaster. Cynthia, we are joined by Colonel Ann Wright, retired, at a very crucial time. She's just back from a visit to Venezuela and Cuba. You want to bring her in and give us a little sense of what's going on with Code Pink on the ground there?
Yes, thank you, Dennis. I'm going to give you a brief introduction about Anne before we have her come on with us, if you don't mind just for a moment. I know Anne as a tireless activist. She travels the country and the world to promote peace and justice everywhere. Here's a little bit about her. She's a 29-year U.S. Army veteran who retired as a colonel, and she's a former U.S. diplomat, and she resigned in March 2003 in opposition to the war on Iraq. As a diplomat, she served in Nicaragua, Grenada, Somalia, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, not sure I'm pronouncing that correctly, Sierra Leone, Micronesia, and Mongolia. And in 2001, she was on a small team that reopened the U.S. Embassy in Kabul. She served as a member of the Code Pink Board of Directors, and she's an advisory board member of Veterans for Peace, International Peace Bureau, World Beyond War, Gaza Freedom Flotilla, No to NATO, Hawaii Peace and Justice, Pacific Peace Network, and Women Cross the DNC. So, Anne, welcome so much for joining us today on Pink Notes. I'm really, really happy that you're here. And you just returned from a trip to Venezuela. And I wonder if you could tell us about that humanitarian delegation, peace delegation to Venezuela. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Cynthia and Dennis. It's a pleasure to be with you all. And as you mentioned, I've just come back last night from Venezuela. We were there 4 days as a part of a Code Pink delegation of 19 people, 17 from the U.S., one from Brazil, and one from Colombia. We met with government officials. We met with civil organizations, and we met with just people on the street. And The bottom line is, of course, they are horrified about what the United States did in the abduction, the kidnapping of the president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, and his wife, Celia Flores, who Celia herself had been president of the National Assembly and a minister of justice of the country of Venezuela. So the country is, as we in the United States are disturbed about yet one more criminal act that our country has done, which is the kidnapping of a head of state and bringing that person and his wife to the United States to go on trial for alleged drug dealings. It'll be very interesting to hear from the court what all is alleged, although already the indictment against President Maduro has been edited to eliminate some of the initial things that were in the indictment. Bottom line, though, is that people are very disturbed about the U.S. taking military action. They want peace. They don't want to have a confrontation with the United States, even though the last many years since the Hugo Chavez administration, the United States has been putting extraordinary sanctions on the country, making it difficult for people to live. And there has been a migration out of Venezuela as things get tougher and tougher there because of U.S. Sanctions that have been put on the country. And now that the U.S. has nominally kind of taken over at least the oil industry, the people are very concerned about what is the U.S. going to steal all of the resources of Venezuela under the cover of the kidnapping of the head of state, and all of that's yet to be determined.
All right. Well, talk a little bit now about this was a violent attack on Venezuela. Over 100 Venezuelans died. Could you describe the violence that took place and the kinds of destruction that the United States left in the face of this illegal international kidnapping of a president of a country?
Yes, indeed. We went to the commune, the large neighborhood that was right close to where the presidential residence was, where they took President Maduro and Celia Flores. And the description by people that live in that area of what happened was, was graphic and chilling. And as the people there, so we've still got PTSD from hearing all of the explosions that happened, of having electricity blown out, and having windows blown out by the force of the explosions, hearing all of the gunfire from the F-16s, the bombs that were dropping from the F-16s, the gunfire coming from various helicopters that were coming in at very, very low level. And in fact, the president, President Trump, at the State of the Union on Tuesday, gave the Medal of Honor to one of the helicopter pilots who took in part of the Delta Force. The helicopter pilot was shot while they were bringing in the helicopter. That was the first time that we have really heard anything about whether or not any U.S. military were injured. But the 100 or more Venezuelans that were killed by the U.S. forces in the abduction, plus the 32 Cuban military that were there, it was a violent scene. And in order to get into that place, they were knocking out communications equipment all over that part of Caracas. And we did visit an Institute for Scientific Investigations, which is a long name for an educational facility up on top of one of the hills. And the communications facility was knocked out and debris damaged lots of buildings that were in that scientific area, to include a nuclear reactor. The nuclear reactor is for making medical isotopes, but it does have a large pool of radioactive waste that is in that facility. And it was just right down the hill from where the U.S. blew up this communications facility. And they were just, the world is lucky that none of the debris severely damaged that building. However, there were other buildings that were holding medical equipment, dialysis equipment, that were destroyed. So the types of destruction that was going on kind of the cover for the ability to go in and kidnap Nicolas Maduro was substantial. And it has given the people of Venezuela an eerie feeling about, the throwbacks to what the U.S. has done in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and the level of destruction that the U.S. is capable of. which the Venezuelans say, we don't want that. I mean, you are not our enemy. We'd like to be friends with you if indeed you could get your governments to actually treat us with respect and acknowledge that we are a sovereign country and that we have to work out issues, but they shouldn't be at the point of a gun.
If there was an attack like the attack that the United States conducted in Venezuela against the United States, what do you think the response would be? What kind of violations, what kind of laws have been broken? This is a war crime, a multiple with multiple deaths, right? How do we move forward in terms of diplomacy here?
Well, that's tough, although to the credit of the administration, which was sworn in, the vice president of the country, Dulce Rodriguez, at the order of succession, when the president is out, the vice president was sworn in by the Constitutional Court, and no cabinet ministers resigned. There was no argument about who was going to lead the country. So she's been leading it, and it has projected a sense of calm throughout the whole country. However, there are, a lot of Venezuelans are saying, well, why are you meeting with, like, the head of the CIA, the head of U.S. Southern Command, the head of the Secretary of Energy for the United States, which she has done. But in the ability of trying to keep a calmness, acknowledge that the United States had several different plans going. One of them was the abduction of the president. The other one was an abduction plus a huge amount of destruction of facilities. And one of the things that that we got from everyone is that they want peace. They don't want more violence to occur, and they want to be treated with respect and acknowledgement that they are an independent country and should be treated as such. So despite all of the criminal acts that the U.S. government did on the people of Venezuela, they told us as American citizens that we don't hate you, but we certainly don't like what your government is doing.
All right, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We have the honor of being joined by Colonel Ann Wright, retired former U.S. Army Reserves in the U.S. Diplomatic Corps for many years. Also joining us is our pink, Code Pink co-host, Cynthia. Join us.
Thank you, Dennis, and thank you, Ann, so much. I don't know how you keep going. You're amazing. Your energy is just amazing. Thank you. So I'd like to give people a heads up that this tax day coming up on April 15, we're going to be organizing events around the country to say we don't want our taxes spent on attacks on sovereign countries such as Venezuela. We don't want our taxes spent on a genocide being carried out by Israel with its partner, the United States, in Palestine. And I'm just giving people a heads up to think about joining together with all the groups, Taxpayers Against Genocide, Code Pink, Palestinian Youth Movement, et cetera. We're going to be doing actions on April 15. So thank you for letting me announce that.
And before we let you go, Ann, where do you go next? What do you think the mission should be for Code Pink? What do you think the mission should be for the American people and the future of, is it possible to rescue, or are we heading hell-bent into something that looks awfully like fascism?
Well, I think we are in a movement toward fascism, which we all have to push back against. And there certainly have been lots of instances of that. In the last 2 weeks, I've also been up to Minneapolis, where citizens there are challenging ICE in such dramatic ways and paying a price for it. But they're doing it. Also, I wanted to mention, I've just come back from Cuba. And I was there right after the January 3rd U.S. Kidnapping at Nicolas Maduro. And as you can well imagine, the people in Cuba who have been under U.S. sanctions for nearly almost 70 years now, and with the lack of fuel because Venezuela normally would send fuel to Cuba, and that's been cut off by the U.S. It's been, you know, people are scared that the U.S. may do to Cuba what they did to Venezuela. And the effects of all of the sanctions the U.S. has had on Cuba was really, really dramatic. The last time I was there was a year before, and the number of electrical blackouts that were happening, the lack of fuel for cars, and not that everybody has a car in Cuba, that's for sure, but it was a noticeable downturn in everything. And then to add on to it, the fact that another head of state in a neighboring area had just been abducted. As you mentioned, what can we do about it? Well, Code Pink Women for Peace and Progressive International and a few other organizations are organizing a caravan to Cuba that will be in March 20th through 23rd. And it will be by air and sea. We hope to have some boats leaving from one of the countries surrounding Cuba, as well as flights that will be coming in from the U.S. and from other parts of the world. To be there in solidarity with the people of Cuba, saying we are not forgetting you.
Well, we appreciate you, Code Pink, and our special segment on Thursday. Thank you, Cynthia Papermaster. Appreciate you. Final 30 seconds. Anything you want to squeeze in here, Cynthia? Go for it.
Sure. I want people to go to codepink.org, our website. Take a look at the events calendar, see what's happening near you. Join with Code Pink. We are a feminist grassroots organization. We're constantly working for peace and justice. And thank you, Dennis, for hosting Code Pink Notes.
You're so welcome, and we'll talk to you next week. We thank the both of you. You are heroes in the eyes of our listeners, and we will be back soon. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's KPFA in the Bay Area, a network founded in 1949 by folks who understood how important it was to have a free speech, non-fretted, no holds barred, truth to power radio station network, the People's Radio Network. More coming up, and guess what? I'm going to tell you right now, we have a special segment, a very moving segment coming up from Kevin Cooper on death row. Kevin is going to tell us about his relationship with Jesse Jackson and how Jesse Jackson played a role on saving his life, Kevin's life, while he's on death row, where he still is. Listen to this.
I'm Kevin Cooper, and I'm still on death row in the state of California here in the year 2026. In 2004, on February the 10th, at 1 minute after midnight, the state of California was planning to torture and murder me via poisonous lethal injection drugs. However, at 11 a.m. on February the 9th, the late Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr. came to San Quentin Prison with one of my attorneys, the late Jimmy Arn Sternberg, and brought me the stay of execution paperwork from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. This wasn't over because the United States Supreme Court could still overturn the stay. But for then, at that time, I was happy. From 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., Reverend Jackson stayed with me and with my other visitors in the visiting room. He did everything he could to take my mind off the fact that I could still be executed if the Supreme Court lifted the stay of execution. He told jokes to make me laugh. He prayed with me, and he prayed for me. He made me cry, and he made me think. He did everything he could to show me that I was important to him. He told me stories about the struggles that we black people have in this criminal justice system, and that the death penalty was no more than a modern day lynching. He told me that we had to have faith that one day we would put an end to this death penalty, and I believed him. I really did. I believed him then, and I still believe that now. At 6 o'clock p.m., I was taken to the death chamber waiting room, but I was not executed that night. the stay of execution held that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals granted me. I thanked him then, and I thank him now for his kindness, for his humanity, and for his caring for everyday people like me. May he rest in peace, and may he rest in power. In struggle and solidarity from death row, I'm Kevin Cooper.
Kevin Cooper from death row. We are watching Kevin and what goes on there for many years. Death row, U.S. prison system, deadly already, even when the liberals are in control. Right now, the U.S. prison system is a killer, and we'll have an open mic anytime for Kevin Cooper, and we thank that sharing, which tells us a lot also about who Jesse Jackson is, who he was. We just lost him. But a beautiful, beautiful story. You are listening to Flashpoints. We're now going to broadcast for you the very powerful Electronic Intifada with Nora Barros Friedman.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Nora Barros Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 874 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Israel continues to kill and injure Palestinians across the Gaza Strip 4.5 months into the fraudulent ceasefire, while adequate and dignified shelter materials, food supplies, and medications continue to be blockaded by Israel and its Western partners. Heavy rains once again hit Gaza this week, flooding thousands of tents and leaving families without proper protection from the elements. Two Palestinians were killed on Wednesday evening in eastern Deir al-Balah in central Gaza in an Israeli attack that targeted civilians, according to medical sources at the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital. On Tuesday, a Palestinian was killed in an Israeli drone attack in Gaza City, according to the Wafa news agency. The Palestinian Ministry of Health in Gaza says that as of February 25th, 618 Palestinians have been killed and more than 1,600 injured since the so-called ceasefire agreement went into effect last October. Writing in Middle East Eye this week, journalist and researcher Maha Husseini reports that, quote, despite the relative lull in large-scale bombardment, attacks have not fully ceased. On the first 2 days of Ramadan, the Israeli military killed two Palestinians and injured four others across the Gaza Strip.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of